everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Hey, thank you for joining me today. It's Giving Tuesday. And for me, every Tuesday is Giving Tuesday when I'm doing my show, It's All About Food, giving you the truth and tools that you need, or that I like to think you might be interested in when it comes to food. I'm really looking forward to today's program. Let's bring on my first guest. Lana D. Povitz is visiting assistant professor of history at Middleborough College. And Lana has written a book, Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice. Let's get right to it. Lana, how are you today?
Hi, I'm well, Karen.
Good. You're in Middlebury College in Vermont. That's where it is, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in my office.
And it's I'm imagining it's a charming little cottage, a college town.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
Very collegey. Yeah.
I haven't been to Vermont in a while, but I've always enjoyed going there because it's just stunning for the most part.
Yeah. So, it's very beautiful. It very contrasts very much with New York City, but also beautiful.
Yeah, I walked all along Central Park earlier today, and I love it. It's just amazing what they've done with it. So, what I wanted to start with is talking about the history of history. And what I mean by that is I loved when I was in school, in elementary school, junior high school, college, whatever. I love most of my subjects. I never cared for social studies or history. And it wasn't until I was an adult and started reading different kinds of history than I was introduced to when I was in school. Because back when I was in school, and this was a long time ago, history was about war. History was about the leaders who had those wars, the victors. And it wasn't until I discovered like Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States that there were lots of other stories that we didn't talk about. And I find those other stories a lot more interesting and compelling. And so do you know when the history of history changed like that, when the stories changed?
Well, you know, there's a lag between what gets published and what gets taught in schools, right? So even when when I was in high school, when I was in college, I didn't have access to the kinds of classes that, for example, my students at Middlebury now get to take, all about, you know, food politics or social movement history. We didn't have any of that. So I think that there was sort of a sea change in the kinds of histories that got written, really starting in the 60s and 70s with all of the social movements, the women's liberation movement, civil rights and black power, the creation of ethnic studies and women's studies departments. And I think that produced a lot of great new stuff, but I don't think it filtered down. I think it took a lot of years, maybe 50 years.
Yeah.
And also to change, you know, publishing also, it can be very conservative. So I sympathize with that sense that history is kind of a lot of wars, a lot of white men, sometimes other great men. You know, we learned, certainly a lot of my colleagues learned about Martin Luther King, you know, but definitely didn't learn about Ella Baker. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I have enjoyed reading the real history once it became available.
Yeah.
Including your book.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I liked a lot of things about your book. One of the things I liked is I'm a New Yorker. I grew up in New York. I mean, I've lived in California. I've lived in the south of France. I've been around. But now I'm back in New York. And I'm an activist. And I'm a food activist. And there's a lot of things in this book that I didn't know that I really enjoyed reading about. So the first question is, you focus on four different organizations, United Bronx Parents, the Park Slope Food Co-op, God's Love We Deliver, and Community Food Resource Center. How did you pick those four? Were there others to choose from? I don't know.
Oh, it's a great question. Well, it was very serendipitous. You know, in retrospect, it looks very obvious because these are four, among the foremost, I would say, successful and effective nonprofit food organizations that the city produced between the 1960s and the early 2000s. But initially, it kind of came together piecemeal. I had done in grad school a project on Park Slope Food Co-op. I had been reading the work of Jan Popendick, who's an amazing sociologist and historian, and she said you should talk to Kathy Goldman, who had been involved with both United Bronx Parents and the Community Food Resource Center. She actually founded it. So I started to investigate those two organizations more, and then I wanted something with a very different kind of politics, and I forget who I was talking to, but somebody said, what about God's Love We Deliver? So I thought, oh yeah, let me check them out. And it kind of just came together that way. But I think that when you read the book, they all do stand out as kind of very differently effective, but effective nonprofits. I actually didn't think I was going to write about nonprofits at all. I had hoped to, you know, this is a grassroots history, and I didn't initially think that grassroots meant nonprofits. But that was one of the big surprises for me, is just understanding how much of leftist energies, progressive energies, got channeled into nonprofit service provision.
Yeah.
But I had thought, you know, I used to work with a group called Food Not Bombs.
Oh, yes.
Food Not Bombs, which is, you know, nationally sort of represented in other places in the world. And I had been interested in kinds of disorganized, intentionally anti-authoritarian kinds of grassroots politics. And I only ended up writing about nonprofits in the end because I wanted to write about groups that really changed something on a large scale. It turns out that nonprofits are often an effective way to do that.
I'm remembering Food Not Bombs. I believe one of their challenges was that in some places you couldn't give food away.
Yeah, in Florida they were criminalizing people for that.
Yeah, crazy stuff, this planet.
Wild.
and the human species that lives on it. I want to talk.
Michael Bloomberg, when he was mayor, would make it illegal for people to donate food to homeless shelters because it didn't necessarily have the right fat, sugar, and salt content.
Oh, goodness.
Regulate it.
Right. Okay, well, keep that in mind when you're considering voting for Democratic potential presidential nominations.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to talk about each of these groups that you highlighted, but before we do, I mentioned it's Giving Tuesday today, and everybody is inundated and overwhelmed with all of the emails and Facebook posts and wherever where all of the organizations are asking for money. I have a nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living. You can find it at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and we put out our notice about Giving Tuesday because, you know, everybody's doing it. The thing is, though, you touched on this in the book, and that is the economy has changed and the government has changed over the last 50 years or so, probably starting with Reagan's time frame, where the government was more giving to people in need, and those benefits are like slowly whittling away. So nonprofits really depend on donations from the public. And there are problems with that, especially where we look for big donations from people who have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally feel that we're giving them a lot more power and that they can make more decisions about what's going on in the world because they have the money, not just for themselves, but to donate to the organizations that need it. And it wasn't always that way, was it?
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
I mean, the government, you know, when Ronald Reagan and others chose to reduce taxes for Americans, they were giving up a big source of money that they could use to help poor people. And that was intentional because it changed the game so that government spending on programs for low-income people and other disadvantaged people, that kind of looked like, that came to look like bad, irresponsible politics. But it was a choice to change the structure of taxation. And I think that's really what's given all this space for private philanthropy to take up so much room.
Exactly. Now, let's start with United Bronx Parents. Can you just give us we don't have a lot of time. I want people to read the book. But can you just give me a brief overview of what they did, who they
were? Sure. So this organization was founded in the 1960s really to work on the inequality of New York City schools. That was its initial goal because the racism of the Board of Education, as it was then called, was so egregious. So it was mostly Puerto Rican mothers, but also some African American mothers who rallied to empower parents to fight for change in their kids' school. And they ended up leading the first sustained grassroots movement to improve school lunch. So they were on this in the late 1960s. I should mention that the organization was founded by Evelina Antonetti, who's an amazing, charismatic community leader who was involved with the organization through the 80s until her death. So they worked on all kinds of issues, drug treatment for women with children, representation of Puerto Ricans in popular, they did all kinds of things, not just food, but they were really in the lead not only with school lunches, but also with setting up free summer meals. So in 1971, and I write about this, the city refused to take on this program, which had become a federal entitlement, which meant that all cities could have free summer meals for children. But it was sort of the city was overwhelmed. So the United Bronx Parents ended up taking it on, and they administered the program, feeding hundreds of thousands of children each day. So they're quite cutting edge.
I'm not sure where school lunch programs are around the country today, but some of what you wrote about was the changes that were made, and some of the changes were to support feeding children industrial processed foods that you could easily heat up. So equipment was purchased to just do the heating up rather than installing real kitchens where you could make real food.
Yes, and the Puerto Rican mothers, to their credit, absolutely hated that microwave system. A lot of these mothers, even though they were poor, were wonderful cooks, and they really knew what their children would eat and what would make for good food. And they also knew that people in the South Bronx in the late 60s and early 70s needed jobs. So what they had proposed, which was very innovative, was that schools that had kitchens should be allowed to cook for all of the schools in the area that didn't have kitchens, on-site, fresh, hot food. And then the Board of Education completely ignored their suggestions, all of which were really replicable, really doable. They did a model lunch to prove that they could do it for even less money than the board was spending on lunches. And they just wouldn't, the board just wouldn't hear it. And they just installed these, what were called convenience kitchens, to serve students this horrible processed food that was bad for them, and most of which got thrown out, as it still can. So they weren't successful in that sense. But they did have an awareness of what it could look like to do school lunch well.
And I'm sure it's very different all over the United States, where you have some places that today make nutritious meals and other places that just don't.
Yeah. But New York City is quite special because it recently, I mean, there's a few other cities that do this too, but as I'm sure you know, they recently implemented universal school meals, which is something that, you know, food advocates have been fighting for 50 years or more. Will your listeners know what I mean by universal school
meals? No, tell us.
So this is a really important thing. So when there are public feeding programs, and that could be school lunches, that could be school breakfast, that could be food stamps, EBT, WIC, the Women and Infants and Children Feeding Program, all of these programs are entitlements. American citizens, or sometimes even non-citizens, should be able to access them. But when these programs are means tested, which means when people have to submit paperwork to talk about what kinds of money their family makes, that really stigmatizes the programs, and it gets them to be seen as poor people's programs or poor kids' programs. And then children especially will stay away from those programs. So in a school where kids who are receiving the free meals have to wait in a different line than the ones who are paying full price, it brings down the status of the program, and it makes people not want to use it. So Universal School Meals deals with this by doing away with means testing. It means they're available to everybody, whoever wants one, whether they technically need it or sort of need it or don't need it but just want it. Everybody's all getting the same thing. And what that does is that it increases the quality over time, because middle-class kids come to use those programs too. And the stigma sort of is gone when that happens. So it's quite important. And there actually was a study recently published by the university, the Syracuse University, I believe, called, I think it was like Let Them Eat Lunch, which just says, which was something everybody knows intuitively, teachers certainly know, that students who eat breakfast and eat lunch do better in school than the ones who are hungry and can't learn as well. But they proved somehow that they gain up to 10 weeks of learning by everybody eating lunch. So, you know, I don't know about quantifying things in this way, but it's a really important issue and it pays huge dividends. So if we lived in a country that was really serious about educating people, food provision would be a no-brainer.
That's right. I would think, too, I know there are some people who don't want to pay taxes so that other people get benefits. And something like this would be more minimal to them because it's for everyone.
Right.
I would hope. Yes.
I mean, hopefully, but if we really want to look at what the government spends its money on, we know it's not welfare programs.
Yeah.
You know, we know it's the military. It's a huge difference. These amounts of money to feed people are so small. They're so inconsequential. It's really a lot. It's quite symbolic, I think, more than about crunching actual numbers.
Okay, so then there's the Park Slope Food Co-op, and I've been there, and mm-hmm. I love it. And it was really fun reading about the history. We don't have a lot of time, so I just want to say, if anyone is interested in food co-ops, this is a great source to read about the Park Slope Food Co-op, because it's the best in the country, right?
Yeah, the New Yorker just did a great piece on it.
Oh, I have to read that.
And yeah, it's good.
Do you know what issue it was? Because I've got a stack of New Yorkers at home waiting for me.
Oh, I think it was 2 issues ago.
Okay, good. I'll look for it. And if people want to start a co-op, which I think is a great idea, you can learn a lot from the Park Slope Food Co-op in terms of what works and what doesn't work and things to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love the history. The one point that you made about how it was primarily started by a bunch of, can I just say, privileged white people? I don't know how else to.
Sure.
I don't know how
they
else
would agree.
To say it. There are advantages and disadvantages to that. Certainly, they all were like in sync, so they could agree on things a lot more easily, I suppose.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely make that argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just something that happened, and it worked.
And it has worked. The thing is, it's not incompatible to say that people were white and privileged and worked really hard and had great ideas and made a thing happen. You know what I mean? Sometimes both of those things go together.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was more about not having structures in place to deal with not only challenges to capitalism, because as a co-op, they're kind of already doing that, but what to do about the force of white supremacy in the world, you know, what to do about, to a lesser extent, gender issues. Although, to be fair, most people, everyone I spoke to sees it as a pretty egalitarian space, gender-wise. But the race thing is difficult. I mean, that's what happens when all white people start something. It often has a lot of racism.
But they've worked through that over the years.
They're working on it. I mean, I don't think that's something any organization that has a lot of white people ever fully works through. But I think there's been a lot of efforts to deal with instances of bias and discrimination. I think that definitely in hiring and staff policies, it's certainly a very diverse place racially. I don't really know. I mean, the thing, as a historian, I don't really have to contend with what's happened, you know, what's happening right now. I do know there's a conversation about whether the staff, some staff want to unionize or not, and that's been interesting, but I'm not quite sure what's happening with that.
Okay, let's move to God's Love We Deliver. And this one was heart-wrenching. And I loved reading about it, to know that there are good people on the planet. It just inspires me, the whole concept. I love that. So, okay, I won't tell you what I love yet. You tell us about what this organization is first, God's Love We Deliver.
So God's Love We Deliver was founded at the early on during the AIDS crisis, 1985, by two women who had been devotees of an Indian guru who told them to tend to the dying. So they were actually not part of the AIDS communities. They didn't really have a connection to it, but they saw the suffering of people with AIDS and thought especially how people were kind of being abandoned by their families, sometimes certainly by the city government, the federal government. And there wasn't much being done. So they decided that they were going to bring really good food to people who were too sick to leave their homes, people who were dying. And if you had an AIDS diagnosis before the mid-90s, it may as well have been a death sentence mm-hmm. for many, many, many people. So they innovated this system, initially getting donations from restaurants to bring to people, and then eventually they got their own kitchen and started bringing in all these volunteers to cook meals and to deliver them to people's homes. And then they expanded to also feed people who had other kinds of illnesses that were keeping them homebound. So there's all kinds of people who can qualify for that today. It's an ongoing organization. It's a wonderful organization. You can call and get a free meal delivered tomorrow. It's tailored to your health needs. There's no wait list. And, you know, it's helped a lot of people in a very practical, meaningful way. But what I talk about is not only the people who it helped, who were receiving the meals, but the people who had a way of being of service through whether it was chopping carrots and potatoes or driving a truck or soliciting donations. I mean, whatever people kind of wanted to do, there was a space for them to do it. And that's what was really amazing about the organization, is that it gave so many people a way in to this crisis that otherwise was, you know, filling people with despair. People were losing all of their friends every week. There was no cure. There was nothing to do a lot of the time except to organize or to provide. So there's a lot of conversation that goes to ACT UP, which is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which is a kind of direct action group. And then there's a kind of service providing work that people like God's, or organizations like God's Love We Deliver gave to people.
Well, one of the things that I loved about this section, but the whole book, are all the little stories that involved individuals and their successes and their challenges. But I just wanted to mention now, what I loved was when you said they were getting started and they were using restaurants, and they would just call up a high-end restaurant and say, I want to make an arrangement where I call you, I order a meal that my client wants, we have somebody pick it up, we don't pay you, and that's it. And they agreed.
Yep. A lot of restaurateurs agreed. And this is kind of the thing that the founders found, which is that people are actually very eager to help. If you give people work that they can actually do, and you have a request that makes sense and that people are capable of doing, people are very eager to be generous. And a lot of the time inaction happens because people don't know, there's no channel for their goodwill to flow through. And, you know, a lot of those restaurateurs knew, you know, they were a part of the communities that were being hit. So they understood what was happening. And I think they were actually quite grateful that they had an opportunity to do this, to be of service in that way.
Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to touch on the Community Food Resource Center. Can you tell us a little bit about that group?
So that's a wonderful organization. It no longer directly exists, but the kind of current version of it is an organization called Community Food Advocates, which is still doing amazing work. But Community Food Resource Center was founded by Kathy Goldman in 1980, right as Reagan was getting elected. And originally what they wanted to do was expand federal food programs to make them sort of proliferate throughout New York and to bring in good food jobs. I mean, now we have the language of good food jobs, meaning jobs that are in the food service sector that are well paid. And the initial vision was very much to expand that. As Reagan started to undo the social fabric of the country, they got into a mode of just trying to stop things from getting worse. And so they ended up doing, on one hand, they were advocating still for these food programs, trying to stop cuts to food stamps, trying to stop cuts to welfare, but they were also increasingly providing direct services. So they were the group, one of the groups behind founding the New York City Food Bank. They founded a model soup kitchen, a community kitchen in Harlem that not only fed people, but also hooked them up with other kinds of services they might have needed. So legal assistance, housing assistance, that kind of thing. So they were a very interesting organization because they were both providing direct services and doing advocacy. And that combination was really important. It really meant that the advocacy was based on a direct knowledge of what people were going through. And instead of just doing the service part, they were also trying to change the circumstances to make it so that the food bank would go out of business, which obviously they were not successful in doing because of the way late capitalism has structured things. I mean, it turned out to be much easier to build model service programs than to create a socialist society, which was sort of what they would have preferred.
So you said in the beginning of the program you weren't planning on writing about nonprofits. And one of the reasons of the demise of the Community Food Resource Center was because they were a nonprofit, and the founder, who had had a vision and a way to run it, when she decided to step down and replace the executive director position with someone else, things changed dramatically. And this can happen a lot with a nonprofit when the board votes in someone new and things change, even though she was the one who had selected this person. I just want to say, can you talk a little bit about that with nonprofits, since you've learned a lot about them?
Well, what I can say, and I hope this is to your question, is that who the leadership is matters a lot. Nonprofit spaces are very social, and to a large extent, the work depends on how people are able to work together, to learn from each other, to share a vision, to inspire each other. And so, I mean, I saw that across my studies, that people continued to stay in this work, which was quite depressing and full of defeats oftentimes, more often than not. So to have strong leadership mattered greatly. I mean, in the case of Community Food Resource Center, the person that they chose to manage it, that Kathy Goldman chose to manage it after her, he sort of ran it into the ground, but a lot of those programs continued to exist under the auspices of the Food Bank for New York City. So in other words, when ideas are good, when programs are working well, they find a way to continue. It's not like that work ended. The Earned Income Tax Credit and Tax Preparation Assistance was a CFRC program, Community Food Resource Center program, and now the Food Bank carries it out. So that's just one example of many that I could name to show that the kind of long-term history of these places sometimes unravels in unexpected ways, unspools in unexpected ways.
All right. Well, I want to say again that I really enjoyed reading your book, Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice. It's really fine. I mean, history, like I opened, history can be boring or it can be good. And it's especially good when it contains good stories about individuals. And this book certainly does, and it was inspiring and also frustrating because we have so much more work to do when it comes to food.
Yeah, struggle continues. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for writing Stirrings, and thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Take care.
Take care. Okay, everybody, that was Lana D. Povetz. Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice.